this particular topic, an argumentative culture, and asking the question, is it influencing the church? And of course, we said that it was. I didn't get as far as I wanted to in this class, so I thought we would finish the class tonight and kind of close it out. And a bunch of folks had some great comments and conversation, and we do want to continue that tonight. You know, we kind of started off last week in looking, you know, we live in a country that likes a good fight. We live in a country that likes to argue. We see it on television. We see it in social media and other different things. But unfortunately, because of that and because we live in the world, we're not of the world, we can be influenced by the world. We understand that. And because we can be influenced by the world, many times that influence will creep its way into the church, sometimes unaware. The devil loves that when it comes in unaware, because that's the type of individual that he is. But because of those things, and because they find their way into the church, and because we pick up this worldly mentality, many times it carries over into the way that we handle ourselves, and it causes schisms, and it causes divisions in the church, and it causes problems. You know, Paul addressed this greatly with the Corinthian church. There was a lot of schisms that were taking place. He told them they needed to be of the same mind and same judgment in 1 Corinthians 1:10. He told them there should be no schisms or divisions that were taking place in the church in 1 Corinthians 12:25. So it's not a new problem. But Paul was warning the church at Corinth to be on the lookout for these things, because you're going to have brethren that were going to come in and that were going to try and cause problems or bring issues into the church. Of course, there was a plethora of problems that were taking place at Corinth, but there was also this division that was beginning to kind of creep in and cause problems. One of the things that's beginning to happen today is this argumentative mindset that's coming into the church, and all of it really kind of boils down, and what we're going to summarize our class up tonight is that a lot of compassion and a lot of mercy has been left out. Now, I said from the onset last week, that does not negate the concept that we have to defend the truth, right? Jude 3 says we've got to be contenders of the faith. That doesn't mean we go out negating truth. But there seems to be this mindset today of some in the church and some in the brotherhood, and I think in a way, coming from preaching in the Southeast, I think in a way the church here in North Carolina is somewhat sheltered from a lot of the things that do take place, and that's a good thing. But it does happen, and it can happen, and we see it happen all of the time. One of the things we mentioned last week in relation to looking at our number one priority in the church is not to defend the truth. Huh? What's our number one priority? Matthew 28:18-20, right? Mark 16:15-16. That doesn't mean we negate defending the truth when it comes to us, but it doesn't mean that God set our sole purpose in life when it comes to preaching and teaching the gospel is to go about looking for a fight which to pick. That's not our job. But there are some in the church that think that's their job. You have some that are attacking denominations and going out there and trying to start fights. And really, all that does is bring this mentality to the church as if we're pharisaical in relation to it. One of the things I pointed out last week, when Jesus went into the temple and he saw the money changers, did he address the issue? Yes, he did. He turned over the tables. He was upset with what was taking place. They were turning his father's house into a den of thieves. He said, this is not going to happen. But can you turn in your Bible and tell me after that where he was going about looking for money changers? Was that his sole purpose? He was going out trying to find trouble and trying to find individuals who were still using the money changer issue. No, that's not what he did. His concern was to seek and to save that which was lost. And I think the church, in many areas, and I can tell you this personally coming from the Southeast, has gotten away from that mindset. We've gotten away from the mindset of looking for souls that are lost and trying to pick fights with people who we think we can pick fights with. And that doesn't do anything good for the church as a whole, and it doesn't paint us in this great light. We have to be defenders of the truth, but we also have to be lovers of men, and we have to be lovers of soul too. And it's not to say there aren't problems in the brotherhood that need to be addressed, like fellowshipping denominations and some of the other things that are out there today too. But if we spend our time in the Great Commission with that sole focus, don't you think everything else will take care of itself? If we're looking for lost souls, if that's our primary purpose, is to teach people the gospel, who will then in turn also teach other people the gospel, because that was kind of the whole plan of what Jesus had in mind when he sent his disciples out to go into to all the world to preach the gospel to every creature. And by preaching that, we teach the truth. And if you understand the truth and you have the truth, you understand what counterfeit is, so when that counterfeit comes along, you can defend the truth rightfully. But at the same time, if we're always trying to pick a fight, as we see individuals, you know, raising, you know, signs and different things like that, that homosexuals are going to hell and all these different things, understanding we have to preach against those things, but that mindset is not going to bring people into the church. Because when Jesus had compassion on lost souls, when he sat down with people, did he sit down and say, you know what, I think you're going to hell. You know, I know what kind of person you are, and all the sinners were coming to him, but you know what, you're one of those bad sinners, so you can stand over here in this line, and if you're lucky, I'm going to get to you. And if that's the mindset of the church, brethren, we got a long way to go. Because compassion is being left out from the aspect of what it means to evangelize and to teach people and to teach lost souls. You know, we also talked about some last week before we get into our other, we were looking at some of the reasons. Okay, hit the wrong button. We were looking at some of the reasons that this argumentative culture is kind of creeping into the church. And one of the things we talked about too is this faulty gauge of faithfulness. You know, we kind of put into our own minds how we think we're going to determine whether or not somebody's faithful. And one of those gauges was, well, if you agree with me, then you're faithful. If you agree with my scruple, then you're faithful. If you don't agree with my scruple, well, then, you know, we can't be buddies and we can't have fellowship. Unfortunately, that's made its way into the church too. The other thing that we talked about real quick is the assumption of guilt by association. And I mentioned to you last week how I, you know, was invited to go to lunch with a Baptist preacher when I was in Alabama. I took the opportunity to go sit down with him. And one of the things we talked about and discussed in great detail was the necessity of baptism for salvation. Why would I not take that opportunity to sit down with somebody who asked me to discuss that topic? But because some people saw me sitting down with a Baptist preacher, guess what they thought? Larry's guilty. Guilt by association, right? Jump to conclusions many times. The Bible talks about that too. But we have this mindset that it's like we're always on the prowl to pounce. And that's, to me, it's not a way to live as a Christian. It's like we're always ready to defend and jump and to pounce on people in the church. As soon as we hear one thing particularly wrong, or maybe we don't completely agree with something, rather than having the mindset, and we're going to look at some of the results here in just a moment, of having the mindset of which our country does not do today, of having a discussion. Case in point, you look at the political environment today. There's no such thing as discussions anymore. Somebody brought up, I don't remember who it was, I think it was Jeff last week had mentioned this, about debates, how we used to see debates and, you know, the orators of the day back in the 30s and the 40s and 50s and even into the 60s, and how you had these debates between, you know, preachers in the Lord's church and denominational preachers, but you didn't hear them screaming at each other and demeaning each other and beating each other down. They had good spiritual debates over biblical issues, and what they did is they preached to these audiences where they were presenting the truth, or some thought they were presenting the truth, and you would have individuals then who were opening up their Bibles and being converted to Christ. But they weren't up there berating each other. They weren't up there beating each other down and calling each other names. Case in point, I saw an article written a few years ago by a preacher in the Lord's church, and it kind of upset me, talking about another preacher in the Lord's church whom he assumed was unfaithful in some of the things he was teaching. I don't know. I didn't really know this guy. But the title of the article was, "This Brother Has a Maggot in His Brain." Now, that's a Christ-like attitude if I ever saw one, right? What's that? Just said, this brother has a maggot in his brain. So apparently something was going on in his brain for what he was teaching. But all I saw was the article, and I put it in the trash because it's nothing that I wanted to read, because I could already tell the point of view that he was going to take automatically was to start berating this brother and start knocking him down. I didn't know the issue, so I wasn't going to get into the issue in that particular case. But again, you know, we have this idea that there's guilt by association. I've told you in cases of gospel preachers speaking on lectureships, and because they spoke on this lectureship and said brother spoke on this lectureship who was teaching something or something this other brother didn't even know, and all of a sudden because he spoke on this lectureship, now he's an apostate and unfaithful preacher. He said, brethren, that mentality ought not to be in the church. But unfortunately, it's creeping into the church. Robert, go ahead. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And that's kind of brings me to the next point as far as some of the results because of this argumentative idea that's getting into the church. And this is where we left off last week, was there's a greater polarization among the brethren in the church. And many times, some brethren don't even know why that polarization is taking place. You know, I told you I did that particular gospel meeting, and there was four or five congregations in that area that didn't fellowship, and I asked the preacher why. And he said, I don't know. Just, they told me we don't fellowship when I got here, so I just assumed we didn't fellowship, and I just left it alone. I said, so we're not going to reach out and find out what the issue is, and maybe it was a family debacle that took place 40 years ago that's no longer even an issue because that family's not even here anymore? But again, we have this mindset automatically, if somebody tells us something, or we see it on the internet because we know everything on the internet is true, because we hear something, or we see something, read something, or see something on the internet, we automatically think said brother or said thing is true. And when you think about Matthew chapter 18, and that whole concept of having ought against somebody or wanting to find out what the truth is, the Bible tells us to do what? Go to the person, right? But we automatically assume. I told you, case in point, when people are traveling, people ask me sometimes about a particular church in an area and if it's sound and, you know, is it a church they can attend? And I've been guilty of this. I'll be the first person to tell you. And I'll say, well, I heard that they do this, this, or this. Never once investigating for myself, never once calling the congregation or asking the preacher if that was actually what they did. So shame on me. Instead of saying, well, I know some congregations in the area, I'll call for you or hear some numbers that you can call to find out whether or not these congregations are going to be sound or not. So again, it goes back to simply investigating for the fact of understanding. We can't, you know, jump to conclusions, or the polarization that's beginning to take place is causing a lot of issues in the church. It's also prevented some honest discussion among a lot of sound brethren. Let me tell you why. Because of this polarization and this concept that's taking place, and you have some brethren out there that are attacking good, sound gospel preachers, many gospel preachers are afraid to preach sermons that might cause people to think, or that might be more difficult topics, because they're afraid they're going to be written up, or they're afraid they're going to be talked about, or they're afraid they're going to be looked at as unsound or unfaithful, or whatever the case is. And that's unfortunate, because the truth in some cases is not being preached. But because of that, we're not having the honest discussions that were supposed to be happening, and this argumentative mindset is creeping into the church. You know, there was a time when brethren could debate an issue and remain friends, but that's no longer the case. That's what the devil, like Robert was saying, wants us to do, is to have this mindset and allow it to creep into the church and begin to cause these schisms. You know, we can no longer, as I sat down with that Baptist preacher and had an honest study and discussion over the issue of baptism and concerning its salvation. Because that's not what anybody wants you to do. Pray tell this, when you think about the Sadducees, who didn't believe in the resurrection, by the way, did Jesus ever have discussions with them, or the disciples ever have discussions with the Pharisees and Sadducees? Yeah, they did. Just because they disagreed didn't mean they weren't going to have discussion, because somebody obviously has the truth. You either one has the truth or the other has the truth, but somebody has the truth. And again, Jude 3 tells us we've got to be defenders of the faith, but at the same time, we've got to be willing to have the discussion. Again, that doesn't mean we supersede doctrine or we go above that which is written. We don't add to, we don't take away. All of those things the Bible tells us to do. But I think we've gotten so scared to reach out into our communities and to have that discussion because we're afraid of what other people might think of us. I'm just worried about what Jesus thinks of me. And if I can have an honest discussion with somebody who's lost in error, brethren, pray tell, that ought to be my mentality. If I can sit down with the Bible and say, let's talk. Jeff, go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Sure, absolutely. You know, I found in many of my Bible studies that I've had with people, those that are in denominations, those that know nothing or think they know something about religion, many times the religious discussions that I have, they're coming from a standpoint of something that they've always heard. I have a lot of people, as I visit hospitals and go about and talk to people and go to funeral homes and do funerals and all these things, guess what they call me? Pastor. It's because it's what they've always heard. I don't get upset when somebody calls me pastor. I know some preachers that will go off the deep end if you call them a pastor. But I don't get upset in the sense that they don't know. They don't know any better. So now here's an opportunity for me to say, okay, do you know what the definition of a pastor is? You know, when you look at what the definition of a pastor, a presbyter, an elder, or a shepherd, what the Bible talks about, what an overseer of the church is, do you actually know what that is? Because this is all they've known and all they've ever been taught. So a lot of times, and I don't mean this derogatory, it comes from a state of ignorance because it's what they've heard in society, right? So instead of using it as a teaching tool, and sometimes I like to have fun when the telemarketers call and ask for the pastor at the church. But instead of using it as a teaching tool, many times we go back on the end of the defensive mode and we put our fist up like we're ready for a fight. Or when people say, well, you're those people who don't use instrumental music, huh? Well, I don't say, yeah. I say, why do you ask that? Let me ask that with an open-ended question and find out what your area of interest is. Maybe they want to pick a fight, and if that's the case, I'm not interested. But many times, more likely than not, they're simply asking a question because they don't know. They've heard or they've assumed or they've always been told, but we have this argumentative mindset that we're ready to automatically pick a fight with somebody or get into a debate or a screaming match instead of using the opportunity, as Jesus did many times when he was asked questions by the Pharisees. And what did he say? What's the Bible say? What's the law say? Why are you asking that question? What do you say? So many times he would put it back on them to open up the discussion so he can have a talk with them. Just as we looked at in Mark chapter 3 on Sunday night in relation when he went into the synagogues and healing and he looked around with grief and all of that, so he basically asked, what does the law say? He wanted to know where they were coming from. So instead of being on the defensive, because people are not always trying to pick a fight with us, but society and the devil wants us to believe that everybody's trying to pick a fight with us. Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, she's basically saying that there's not a standard of truth anymore because it changes daily. Political views, where she used to work, the truth changed. So there's kind of this mindset of everybody's truth is what they think it is. That, you know, that's kind of the mindset of our society today, unfortunately, is truth is relative, so to speak, or that you can't know absolute truth. And I always ask the question, is that the truth? Obviously, there is a standard, there is a truth. The Bible tells us we're sanctified and we're set apart in John chapter 17. So there is this standard of truth, and we have to understand this is our standard. This is our SOP by which we go by, and that has to be the standard by which we live. You know, I mentioned last week, you know, people ask me a lot of times because I'm a preacher, especially around, you know, political seasons, you know, who should I vote for? How are you going to vote in all of these things? Well, I vote as a Christian. I don't vote for party lines. I vote as a child of God and how I need to vote if I feel like I need to vote. I had a brother in the church go off on me one time when I said, I don't even think I'm going to vote this year, to be honest with you, because there's not anybody out there that's worth my vote. And he thought I was absolutely unscriptural and unfaithful because I wasn't going to vote. And I said, if you can show me book, chapter, and verse that says I'm supposed to vote, I'll be more than happy to do that. Now you go over to that brother in India who doesn't have the same democracy as we do and tell him he's sinning too. I'll be more than happy to vote. Again, it goes back to living as Christ. Here's the third reason. It's diverted attention away from what our main focus should be. You know, Jesus left no doubt what His purpose was in Luke 19 and verse 10, to seek and to save the lost. And if we keep the main focus, in trying to reach lost souls and teaching lost souls, then, you know, and again, if we claim to belong to Him, then, brethren, we've also got to act like Him and make His mission ours. But unfortunately, that's not the case. You know, a lot of brethren, because they're busy arguing over relatively unimportant matters, have been sidetracked by what the ultimate mission of the church is. Case in point, one of my mentors and instructors when I was at the Memphis School of Preaching, and he was director emeritus when I was there, probably the most gentle, kindest man you could ever meet, Brother Curtis Cates, was doing a gospel meeting in southern Georgia. And there was this contention that was taking place in the church with these brethren that had this thing against the Memphis School of Preaching, apparently, and a lot of the things that were untrue that were being said. The elders' mindset, which was probably the most proper and correct thing to do, was don't answer the argument because it's just going to continue with a fight. But as he was walking out after the meeting one Monday night and he's standing in the foyer, this brethren who had this schism against the Memphis School of Preaching for some reason came out and just began to attack him in the foyer with about 50 people around screaming at him. This is a gospel preacher, by the way. Screaming at him, and you just had to understand Brother Curtis Cates' demeanor, just put his hand in his pocket and he stood there and listened. And he let this brother go on for 10 minutes, wanting him to answer all these questions and berate him and tell him how, you know, unscrupulous and what a horrible gospel preacher he was and all of these things. And then when the brother got done, Brother Curtis Cates said, "Brother, are you done?" And he said, "Yeah, what do you have to say?" He said, "I just have one question. How many Bible studies do you have?" Let's take the focus back and make it the main focus. It's not about causing schisms in the church and fights and all of those other things. I can guarantee you this, if error walked into this building, our elders and myself would be the first ones to stand up to defend it. I guarantee it. I have no doubt and have full confidence in our leadership in this congregation. But if we go about trying to look at every brotherhood fight and pick every fight and cause a fight and write articles and brethren against brethren and churches against churches, then we're taking the focus away from saving souls. Because that has to be our number one purpose. That has to be our number one goal. How many potentially soul-saving sermons do you think are abandoned because of discourse for the latest error? And I see preachers get in the pulpit and say, "Well, this is going on in this part of the country, so that's what we're going to address." Why? I've had brethren with ask me what I think about what's going on in Texas or in this particular area or neck of the woods, and I'm sure if I asked Cody one particular instance, he would know exactly what I'm talking about because he lived in that area. And my response is, it's not my concern. I'm not in that area. There's gospel preachers that will defend the truth when it comes to their neck of the woods. They'll take care of the problem. If it doesn't affect us, then I'm not going to worry about it. And brethren that want to get on these Facebook chats and spend all day arguing and going in discourse, last time I checked, you can't baptize that computer. That computer's not going to save anybody's soul. So again, we've got to make the main focus the main focus. There has to, you know, come a point in time, obviously, when we sever ties with those that are in error and we have to move on. I used to have a sergeant major who used to say, "Don't pet a burning dog." At that point, it's probably a little too late. Some things you just have to let go. And unfortunately, there are some brethren in the Lord's church who aren't going to let error go, and they're going to continue to harp on it, unfortunately. But I've always found it interesting, those that get caught up in error go from one extreme to the other. They go from ultra-conservative to ultra-liberal. They swing that pendulum many times. And it's really easy to spot. So let's look at some remedies real quick before we close. What do you think the main remedy would be for a lot of the schisms and the attitudes and those things that are taking place in the church. Pray, absolutely. What else? Yeah, that's what I do many times. Brother Curtis Cates, they used to write him up sometimes. You know what he used to say? I just hope they spelled my name right. He didn't let it bother him. How many times do you think they talked about Jesus and said bad things about him and caused problems because of who he was and what he was trying to do? And what did Jesus do? Kept on preaching. Compassion. You've got to have compassion for souls. Jake, Jack, go ahead. Possibly. Could be. Yeah. And I think some of that comes to, that's not to say it's not in older preachers, because it is, but you see it in a lot of younger preachers as they come out of school with this fire and zeal to save the world. I used to have somewhat of that mindset when I was beginning my gospel preaching career. My wife will tell you that. But as you begin to get tired and you begin to lose your focus of what Jesus called you to do, called to be a gospel preacher, or called to be a preacher of the gospel, rather, 2 Thessalonians 2:14, you have to understand, and what the main focus is to teach people the gospel, save souls, and to love them while you do it. And I don't think there's probably a gospel preacher out there that will tell you that there's been times where they've had that type of mentality, because you get caught on a hobby sometimes, and you have the best intentions. And I you know, most of these preachers and even brethren in the church have the, you know, best intentions. But many times they get blinded because compassion is not in sight. And because they lack compassion, and because there's no compassion, and compassion has to be tantamount. But a lot of times people think compassion too is tantamount to being soft on sin and turning a blind eye to problems. That's not the case. That's not it at all. Jesus was compassionate, but didn't turn a blind eye, did he? Again, going back to Sunday night, Mark chapter 3. Said that he was grieved in his heart when he had compassion for the man with the withered hand. He was angry, but it said that he was grieved and upset. You think that's compassion? Because all they were looking at was the law, the Sabbath, and had no mercy for this man who was hurting and had an ailment, and Jesus was the one that could fix it. So they were blinded by their own hatred, as Jack was talking about, by their own, you know, lack of empathy and lack of compassion for this particular man, that they missed the entire picture of what Jesus was trying to accomplish. And unfortunately, that argumentative mindset has made its way into the church. You know, some brethren apparently believe that in order to fulfill our duty is to contend for the faith, they've got to be mean-spirited. They've got to be hateful and vindictive and spit vitriol and make these headlines and in papers and such that are out there today. And the only thing, you know, and hindsight's 20/20, when I saw that Maggot in His Brain article, I should have wrote him an article and said, what if somebody outside the church saw this? And thought, well, if that's the way your preacher talks, what's he going to say about me if I make a mistake? How's he going to feel about me if I have a shortcoming or miss church or do something stupid, because all of us fall short of God's glory, right? Romans 3, we all sin, we all make mistakes. So how's he going to write me up in the bulletin on Sunday morning? Imagine if that were the case. Again, just because you have compassion doesn't mean you're going to be soft on sin or not correct error. But, you know, we can defend the truth and expose error, but we can never lose our love and compassion for people, because Jesus never did. You know, I think Paul's a great example of this. Somebody read Philippians 3:18, please. I think if there's anybody that was a contender for the faith, it was the Apostle Paul. Philippians 3:18. So Paul's referring to the Judaizers in the church that were trying to bind these Jewish customs, those that were coming over to Christianity, and they were making it a test of fellowship in the church at the same time. And obviously they were wrong, and Paul addressed the issue that they were wrong, but what does it say as he wrote this? Said that he was, what, Jeff? Weeping, or tears, as mine said. How do you think that guy that wrote Maggot in the Brain was crying over that article? Probably not. You know, it makes me wonder how many, you know, in this argumentative sect in the Brotherhood today have truly shed tears because they're heartbroken over error. Because shouldn't we be? Yeah, absolutely. Shouldn't we be upset when somebody falls away or somebody falls into apostasy or somebody's teaching false doctrine or teaching an error that's going to pull further other people away? Sure. But again, there's this mindset that we can't have an adult conversation without having an argument and screaming at each other and going to the Bible and seeing what the Bible says. And, you know, you see it happen all the time. Paul was not soft on sin, but neither did he resort to this caustic cutting remarks and calling people names and picking fights either. You know, it says that he rebuked Peter to his face when Peter obviously was being a hypocrite. He said, I withstood him to his face in public because that was something that needed to be done and Peter needed to be called out. But many times when you see in Paul's writing, as he's writing to the church at Corinth, as he's writing to the church at Philippi, these different congregations, he's sometimes known as the weeping preacher. Not just Jeremiah, but Paul himself was a weeping preacher over error. And I think if we had that mentality more of having the compassion and saving souls, but the biggest thing, and it goes back to what we talked about in our very first lesson, is we've got to have balance. So let's give a pop quiz here. Let's go all the way back to December. What does it mean to be a balanced Christian? You can just guess. I'm not going to flunk you. Yes, ma'am. Okay. Pretty much it. You know, does that mean there's no emotion in religion? No. There's logic and there is emotion. You know, I've told you before, you can't sing some of the songs that we sing or preach on the cross of Calvary or think about what Jesus did and not get emotional, but we don't allow emotionalism to rule how we follow what the Bible tells us to do. And the Bible is very logical and easy to follow concerning what God and how God has written these things to us, that it basically says what it says. We don't have to read into it. His commands are not grievous. They're not difficult for us to follow. But we've got to be balanced Christians. You know, we can't afford to let ourselves lean either to the left or to the right. That is, we have to stay down the center which God has given us. And He expects us to keep our equilibrium and not to get off balance. But nothing in Scripture gives me the right to be argumentative, repugnant, or spiteful. Nothing gives me that right in the Bible. Because if I go about screaming at people and raising signs that homosexuals are going to hell and all of these other things, that's not a Christ-like attitude. Have I been asked if homosexuality is wrong? And I say, yes, it is, according to what the Bible tells me. And people get upset with me? Yes, they have. But never have I done it in a screaming tone or yelling at somebody, telling them they're going to hell, because that's never going to get me anywhere in the conversation with the person. It's not going to open up any door of opportunity. And I've learned that the hard way, believe me. We cannot justify any part of the Bible, you know, for smearing names or constant branding in anything that some of these brethren are involved in. We just cannot be a part of that, because it doesn't do anything good for the name of the church. What are God's expectations for us? He wants us to remain true to His Word, to carry out the Great Commission, and to love souls. That's God's ultimate plan for us as His children. But the way I see some brethren acting sometimes, you just want to say, grow up. Because that's not the way Christ would have done it. Next quarter, on Wednesday nights in here, just to give you a little preview, we're going to be talking about the Jesus style. And what we're going to be looking at is a study, and I don't think I've ever heard a class on it. but I read an article, and it was a good study, and I thought it would be a good class, on looking at Jesus, because we understand that he was the Son of God, but many times throughout the Bible, you see who he was as a man when he was dealing with people. So you see his human side. Obviously, you see the divine side and how he helped souls, and because he had all the Word, because he was the Word, John 1 and verse 1. But it also says that he became flesh and dwelt among us, John 1 and verse 14. So we can look at who Jesus was to take examples, because we can't be like him in his divine nature and be perfect, but we can certainly take his example, and we can teach and preach like him, and we can act like him, and we can follow how he wants us to follow him. So that's all, when you think about how we, you know, are handling this argumentative mindset today, the things that are taking place in the church. Brethren, compassion is a great tool in kindness, which we're going to talk about in March, the first Sunday, and looking at what kindness is. When you think about what the definition of kindness is, it's not what the world says. But when you look at the biblical definition of what kindness is, it would go a long way in the world, and it would certainly go a long way in the church if we have that Christ-like mindset. And what Paul said in Philippians 2:5, let this mind be in you, which is also in Christ Jesus, right? To have the same mind as Christ did is to think like Christ. And I know we hate this whole cliche catchphrase, what would Jesus do? But really, when it comes down to it, when you think about it, that mindset in relation to looking at what the Bible says, we follow his example to have the mind of Christ. All right, any questions or comments? Next week is the sexualization of our society. I thought I'd end on a light note. Anything else? Yes, sir. Sure. The approach, and I can tell you this from experience, the approach is extremely important. Because I can walk up to somebody and open the Bible and say, well, you know you're doing that, so guess what? You're going to hell. That's probably, again, not going to open the conversation up to where I can teach them the truth and speak the truth in love and show them. Absolutely, we have to defend the truth. You know, not negating that, but it comes down to the biblical approach and how we sit down with people. You know, and you look at how Jesus did those things. Even sometimes when you look at Peter in the garden, first thing Peter wanted to do was defend Jesus, didn't he? I mean, he was, and we would commend him for that because he was defending his Lord and Savior. And what did Jesus say? Put your sword away. That's not how we're going to go about this. That's not what I'm about. And Jesus still accomplished his task, but he was trying to teach his disciples at the same time. All right, that's it. Thank you. Appreciate it.